for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. If you thought the Martians were scary, wait till you hear the truth. War of the Worlds with George Eliason and John Helmer on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Good morning to you all. This is John Helmer. Regrettably, George Eliason in the Donbass is not with us yet. We hope he's well. We hope he's not under fire. And we hope to hear from him shortly. So you're stuck with me. I'm not a Martian. I'm not an alien. You won't be hearing in our War of the Worlds program from any armchair generals or any think tankers paid by defense ministries to feed you the propaganda of the War of the Worlds, and in particular the war in Europe. We've fitted a special filter to the microphone. I'm looking at it right now. I'm talking through it. That keeps the propaganda out. This is a program in which you won't be hearing crosstalk. You won't be hearing BBC-type hard talk. This is a simple program in which we invite you to hear the truth. We'll follow up with website substantiation of all the links and all the evidence you may need from what you hear us say. We are not loose-tongued here. Let me tell you what we plan to talk about today. In the first place, we're going to start with the case of Ivan Gershovich. His American name is Evan Gershkovich, arrested in Moscow for arrested in Yekaterinburg, taken to Moscow, taken to court on Thursday for espionage. The Gershkovich case is a very important one to understand. That's our first segment. The second, and that may take us to the 20-minute break, the first break. Importantly, and for new, for novelty, for importance of the events in the War of Europe, we're then going to go to France, where the most significant nationwide rebellion is occurring against the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, and we'll be having Slobodan Despot, or Despot, if you wish to pronounce it in English, coming on to discuss what's happening in France, how to understand it in French terms, and also to understand how the events in France, the near civil war conditions in France, impact on the war in the Ukraine, the NATO and US war against Russia in Europe. If there's time, I'm not sure we'll have time, we'll give you a refresher of the latest news and the latest propaganda and the latest things to take away to understand from under the Baltic Sea on the Nord Stream pipeline destruction. So let's begin. As I say, this is John Helmer. Regrettably, George Eliason isn't with us yet. What happened and what's the meaning of the arrest of the Wall Street journalist Evan Gershkovich in Yekaterinburg on Thursday? If you look at the evidence against him and the espionage charges filed, you'll see that this isn't the case of the Russians barking up the wrong tree, and it's not a case of hostage taking. Of course, subsequently, the exchange value of Gershkovich for a swap of Julian Assange, another journalist in prison on the same charges, the same espionage charges, I need to emphasize, which have been brought against Gershkovich by the Russian side in Moscow, have been brought against Julian Assange in England by the United States. But let me explain. The case against Gershkovich was described on Friday by the foreign ministry spokesman, Maria Zakharova, in Moscow, as everything is simple and obvious. This followed Gershkovich's appearance in Lvotova Court in Moscow, where he's pleaded not guilty to a violation of Article 276 of the Russian Criminal Code. 276 says, and I'll quote a bit of it, transfer and also collection, theft, or keeping for the purpose of transfer to a foreign state, a foreign organization, or their representatives of information constituting a state secret, and also the transfer or collection of other information under the order of a foreign intelligence service to the detriment of the external security of the Russian Federation, if these deeds have been committed by a foreign national or stateless person. That's what Article 276, espionage, has been charged against Gershkovich. Now, according to Zakharova, this is the official foreign ministry state line, quotes, there are many cases when people submitting documents imply that they'll be engaged in a completely different activity. That's called going undercover. Under the cover of a journalist visa or accreditation, judging by the events that have already been described, Gershkovich was engaged in a completely different activity. What happened in Yekaterinburg shows he was not engaged in journalism. The claims made today in court by our special services do not relate to his journalistic activities, but to those activities that are not journalistic. Now, let me explain what exactly Gershkovich did in Yekaterinburg just before his arrest. This isn't clear from the brief closed hearing in court where he pleaded not guilty. And it hasn't been reported, not once, by any US or Western press. There is direct witness testimony by a journalist of Vedomosti at the Moscow Daily and a friend of Gershkovich. His name's Vladislav Posnikov. Posnikov has said to the press, printed in the Urals media, but not in the Western media, that he warned Gershkovich that what he was doing would be interpreted by the Russian government as potentially criminal. Gershkovich ignored the warning. The evidence is that Gershkovich was attempting to collect information of these kinds on the Wagner military group's recruitment and other operations related to combat in the Donbas. He was also pursuing information and asking questions about the military production units of Ural Vagonzavod, based in that region. This state-owned company, Ural Vagonzavod, has been sanctioned by the United States since 2014. What is it? It's the leading producer of the Russian Army's T-90 main battle tank. That's the target of Gershkovich's visit to Yekaterinburg. Those were the questions he raised with the people he was talking to. Now, in May 2022, a White House press release announced that, according to the White House, as a result of our export controls, Ural Vagonzavod and another company were struggling to replenish their military weapons and equipment. They've halted work due to lack of foreign parts. That's what the White House said about Ural Vagonzavod in 2022. Along comes Gershkovich asking questions to see if that's correct. Gershkovich was following up, investigating what he knew to be classified military operations at Ural Vagonzavod. Another regional source, a Duma deputy in the Sverdlovsk parliament, has told the Russian press Gershkovich asked him technical questions about another military industrial company in the region. Among Gershkovich's questions were, how many personnel were working at that company? On how many shifts? On what product lines? And were they suffering from components and other supply problems? Those were the questions Gershkovich was asking. Now, imagine Gershkovich had been a Russian reporter in the United States. And suppose he was subject to the US espionage law, which would apply to what he was asking in Yekaterinburg. The US law for espionage is 18 United States Code, Section 793. The wording of that statute comes from the original US Espionage Act of 1917. It duplicates, in greater words, but in same meaning, exactly what the Russian Article 276 says. But the US Supreme Court since 2017 has repeatedly and consistently found that individuals charged under the Act will not be relieved of their liability for criminal espionage by claiming an exercise of free speech or protected press freedom under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. As recently as 1988, a U.S. Navy intelligence analyst named Samuel Morrison was convicted under Section 793 of the Espionage Code in the United States of sending U.S. satellite photographs of a Soviet aircraft carrier under construction at Severomorsk to Jane's Defense Weekly, a London publication for which Morrison was working part-time. The U.S. Courts at the appeal level ruled Morrison's action was not protected by either press privilege or protection. So if you look closely at Section 793 of the U.S. Espionage Act, you note that the language applies to anyone attempting to obtain a wide variety of military information, including information about factories, weapon systems, and munitions, for what the code calls for the advantage of any foreign nation. Now, consider two things. First, was that what Gershkovich was doing in Yekaterinburg? That's what two witnesses friendly to him say he was doing. One of them, acting as a friend, warned him not to do it. Gershkovich said, "No, I'm ignoring you. I'm just a journalist." Now, that's a matter for the Russian court to determine. If he determines it along the lines of the US Supreme Court, Gershkovich is going to be convicted and go to jail. But note what the sections were on the Russian side and on the US side for the main espionage charges. They turn out to be the same as the charges brought against Julian Assange in June 2020. In the Assange case, there were several indictments. The first accused Assange of violations under the statute of computer intrusion. That was then expanded in what's called superseding indictments in the English court as the US applied to extradite Julian Assange to the United States. The charges were superseded and magnified, escalated to espionage. Espionage meaning Section 793. In short, what Julian Assange is being held in virtual solitary confinement, waiting extradition to the United States for alleged espionage. What Julian Assange has been charged with is exactly the same charge as Gershkovich is facing in Moscow. Now, you won't read a word about that yet in the British press, the American press, or the NATO press, or for that matter, the Russian press. So when President Biden's spokesman says, "We condemn the," I'm quoting, "the detention of Mr. Gershkovich in the strongest terms. We also condemn the Russian government's continued targeting and repression of journalists and the freedom of press," you understand that what's happening here is the US reserves one law for its journalists and quite another law for other journalists who do things the United States doesn't like. And in this case, we have a quite extraordinary situation in which Gershkovich could be exchanged for Assange. Now, the strange thing is about Gershkovich's background, and we're going to break soon, so I have to hurry. He started as a Russian-born boy who grew up in the United States. His real name's Ivan. The American name is Evan. His first journalistic job was in the Moscow Times. The Moscow Times has from the beginning been first a CIA front, then a media operation by Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and finally today it's paid for by the Dutch Foreign Ministry. The Moscow Times has been a haven for journalists to conduct espionage or information gathering undercover as journalists. That's where Gershkovich came from. That's where he's ended up. But the question is, he pleads not guilty to espionage. This is a matter that goes now to the Russian court. And just so you know, what he's alleged to have done, for which he pleads not guilty, is exactly what the United States has accused Julian Assange of doing. We now have to go to break. And when we come back, we'll talk some more, hopefully about France and about the first analysis in the English language of what the rebellion of the French against President Macron will mean for the United States and the NATO war against Russia.
TNT Radio's Jeremy Nell and Germ Warfare.
I like Trump.
All right, so let me just throw it out there. I like Trump. When he won in 2016, I remember my wife and I woke up in the morning and we had a little celebration because every establishment media outlet was projecting a Clinton win. And it was so wonderful to see how he just turned that thing on its head. I know that Trump is flawed. He is a politician. Warp Speed was a disastrous campaign, and he's done a few other policy decisions as president that I didn't like, but it doesn't really matter because I'm not American, so I'm just an outsider observing. I kind of get the feeling, though, that he shouldn't run for president. I don't know. I think he had his time. I can't tell you why. I just somehow think that he's a little too cocksure of himself. I suspect Ron DeSantis might take him in the final lap. I'm not sure. But we'll see how it goes.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
If you're talking about it,
for a strong America, for a proud America, I am running for president of the United States of America.
We're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
For the first time in the War of the Worlds, to one of our correspondents, one of our guests, one of our friends in Europe, to understand better from their point of view how the War of the Worlds looks to them and their people. We're going now to what some people are calling the civil war in France. We come to a situation in which the president, Macron, escapes Parliament and everybody else to give an interview to a children's magazine called PIF. He shows contempt for the French, for the Parliament, and now rules by executive decree. At the same time, the police, the gendarmerie, and the French army become more violent, more provocative, and more dangerous in the streets to increase the level of repression and to deter and punish any form of resistance in France. Let me introduce to you all Slobodan Despot, or Despot, a well-known commentator, analyst, and author on French affairs, based in Switzerland. Slobodan was born in Yugoslavia, as you can tell from his name. He's the author of many important books, including novels, analyses of the war against Yugoslavia, poetry, and he publishes regularly in both podcast form and in writing at antipresse.net, antipresse.net. Thank you for coming today, Slobodan. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, John, for inviting me.
Let's start by the dramatic question, and pardon me if I'm getting too excited. Is France sinking into a civil war?
Well, you know, that's a question that we've been asking for some time now. It appeared when the Yellow Vest movement started, and all of a sudden that sort of bulging civil war stopped. It stopped because COVID happened, if you remember. And now, as the COVID psychosis has gone, we have the next big event, which is the Ukraine war. But this has not allowed the government to limit physically the movements and the liberties of people, so that they can demonstrate again. They can go out on the streets. And whatever happened from 2018 on, and was tamed by the COVID policies, has resumed now in a probably deeper and more violent form. So yes, in a way, France is sinking into civil war, but France is a country, as you know, been in pseudo civil wars since the revolution in 1789.
In this situation, Slobodan, what do you understand to be Macron's objectives? Who supports him, as the polls show him sinking steadily now towards 70% disapproval, a level that he only reached during the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests rebellion, before the lockdown? What's he trying to achieve?
Well, first of all, he's a very, very peculiar figure in the history of French politics and of French democracy. He basically is a man without a party. Well, he was elected in 2017 from being a minister. Before that, he was a banker, as we all know. But he was elected with a movement that he called En Marche. Well, France on its way, or walking, or running, or whatever. France in movement. But the movement that we're talking about, his party, his electoral basis was grown, gathered on his way. He had no political background. He was put into place essentially by a media campaign and a sort of what we could call an internal coup within the French ruling elites. So we cannot talk about Macron as we would talk about his predecessor, Hollande, who was a socialist, and who, by the way, screwed up completely the Socialist Party, or the one who was there before, Sarkozy, who was from the bourgeois right party, who had a political career, who screwed up that party too. But he was a man of classical partisan biography. This is not the case with Macron. Macron is a young leader. He's come from nowhere, just like most of those young leaders in many Western countries, like Justin Trudeau. Like we have those you know, in the Baltic countries, those young dancers and people like that. And we have, yeah, excuse me, there's a huge noise. Like,
I'm afraid like that it's, yeah, they're not gunshots and they're not artillery in Lugansk. I'm afraid there's a fireworks display outside my window.
Oh, okay.
They're celebrating right. the truthfulness of this program and of what we have to say.
Oh,
so
oh,
let's
yeah.
call it a salut.
Yes.
But what... when Macron goes to a children's newspaper to yeah. tell little children answers to questions, all of France laughed at him. But the man's yeah. still serious. He knows his disapproval rating is huge. He is ruling without yes. without parliament now. What game is he playing, and how will it impact? Does he have US support? Does he have NATO support behind the scenes? Is that the basis of his confidence? He can hardly believe that children yeah. will vote for him because they won't.
you know, it reminds me of George W. Bush sitting in a kindergarten on the morning of 9/11, you know. There's a very strange similarity between these situations. But this is very, very significant. Yes, the fact that he's giving now interviews to children's magazines rather than to serious journalists who would ask him serious questions, because he's not into answering serious questions. He doesn't care at all. By the way, when I write his name in an article, I always put a trademark sign behind. It's Macron R, like Dacron nylon, and whatever product that is patented, because he is a patented leader. He has he's been produced by an industry. When he got elected in 2017, we have seen in France. We saw a brainwashing campaign like it never happened before, related to an election. The whole spectrum of the system media was talking about a genius. He was clever. He was smart. He was into all the world affairs. They even boasted about he praised his English. When you hear him speaking English, well, it's laughable, and whatever. And when this happened, my impression was that he was being put into place with a mission. So of course you were asking, does he have the support of United States and NATO? But even before he got elected as a president, as a minister of economy. He is the man who sold to the Americans the one of the key industrial assets of France, which was Alstom, you know, the heavy yes. industry that was sold to GE. That was his first real political move that probably warranted him a very, very a serious support from abroad for his election and on and afterwards. So that... He never cared about elections and people. He knows that he will always have 20% of voters in France who are either retired people, these bourgeois elites of France who are always with the power, whatever the power may be doing, and. He has such a fine-tuned electoral policy. I think it's tuned by specialists that with 20% of voters he can still rule, and he manages to rule even with a minority in parliament.
So, the fireworks have stopped. They're listening to you now. As I understand it, with the collapse of the standard of living of a large proportion of French wage earners, the destruction of the medical care system, this isn't unique to France. I mean, it's happened in the United Kingdom. It's happening all over Europe. Do the French understand that the loss of life, the loss of standard of living, the loss of access to hospitals and so forth and so on, all of this destruction of the public sector, which in France was a whole lot better in some respects than in the United Kingdom, do they connect that to the war in Europe? Do they connect it to the war in the Ukraine? A French hostility to Russia has been intense, as you understand. Hostility to people with Russian names, hostility to all Russians, which is a characteristic right across Europe, and it indicates the success of NATO's propaganda. How do the French view, when they're protesting against Macron's destruction of their standard of living, how do they view the war against Russia?
Well, I would say in a very, very caricatural way, but I would say that every person on the streets fighting against Macron now would vote for Putin if Putin was a candidate in France. Well, this of course is a very 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 gross statement. But what I mean is that, first of all, the political spectrum of parties represented in the parliament does not to me render the real feelings of the population. My job is to, you know, I write things. I have my subscribers in France. I'm often there. It's my core language. French is my core language. Although I sometimes forget that I'm not a French citizen. But when you talk with people, they are desperate. They know that their politicians will not represent them. They will drop them along the road. When you know. The French Parliament, all of French Parliament, did a salute. They were all bowing before Zelensky. You know, there was no exception. And the people are not like that. They perfectly understand, and they understood it. You know, even before this war started, they understood when France declined. Unlawfully, and they broke a contract with Russia for the delivery of two helicopter carriers, if you remember, yes. Mistral yes. models. This was done under the former president Hollande, and people, lots of people in France, in the military, in the opposition media, in the society, they felt that something was deeply wrong, because first of all, it was a big loss. It was a loss, I mean, a material financial loss for France. It was a loss of trust, of course. And it was a sort of declaration of war that was really unnecessary at that moment. And they were feeling that France was being drawn into the core, you know, the core of the most aggressive nucleus of the NATO system, not just standing by like they used to do, but they were really the spearhead now of NATO. Well, and what I read by the well, yes, tell me.
Well, I was just going to say, as you remember, François Hollande has recently given an interview to one of the Kiev newspapers, saying that all along he, like ex-Chancellor Merkel, aimed to promote the rearmament of the Ukraine to fight Russia, and that he supported the notion of delay and denial of the so-called Normandy format negotiations on Minsk Accords. In other words, Hollande now claims credit for French policy of aiming to attack Russia through Ukraine, but taking time from 2014 on. Is that a popular view? Is that what people who voted for Macron actually support? Is there a solid base of French support for fighting Russia, whether it's to the last Ukrainian, the last German? Is Hollande's view shed even by the socialists in France, if there are any of them left.
Yeah, first of all, I think that after Hollande dropped by, there was no socialists left. So it's now a very, very marginal party. It's a historical party, but now it's marginal. But that's not the point. The point is that when you see those statements, you read those statements, and you wonder, well, why does he need now to say such things? The former president. Why did Merkel need to say that? Why did Poroshenko? Poroshenko was the first one who stated that Minsk was just, you know, was just a maneuver.
Can I ask you to hold, Slobodan? No. Can I interrupt you just a minute? Ask you to hold the thought.
Please.
Stay tuned while our radio network has a break and tells listeners a lot more than I can for the moment. Let's come back to the answer to your question right away. We go to break.
De-weaponizing
now.
Weather
with reality and perspective.
There is a big El Nino coming on. Looks like it's going to be strong. I don't know if it's going to be a super Nino, but it looks like it's certainly going to be the strongest since 2015 and 2016. And of course, that's going to have major implications globally as far as the weather goes. Now, usually when El Ninos show up, the Atlantic hurricane season goes down. But I've never seen sea surface temperatures this warm in front of a El Nino in the Atlantic basin. In fact, the entire ocean is warming up at what I consider a rate that can only be accomplished by the input of geothermal energy from the bottom of the ocean. But this particular year, when I look at the Atlantic hurricane season, I'm saying, well, this is not so easy as normal. And it may wind up that even though there may be less than normal activity in the Caribbean and into the islands, further north for the United States, there still could be real trouble. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The trusted news initiative, TNI, is described as a means for news organizations to rebuild trust and tackle the next disinformation challenges. The BBC's Trusted News Initiative is a partnership that includes First Draft, Google, YouTube, Twitter, Reuters, Meta, The Washington Post, Microsoft, Associated Press, Agence France-Presse, Financial Times, EBU, and Nation Media Group. The BBC website states it is the only forum in the world of its kind designed to take on disinformation in real time. 2 weeks after the World Health Organization announced the COVID-19 pandemic, on March the 11th, 2020, Canada's CBC reported that TNI had announced plans to tackle harmful coronavirus disinformation. Censoring organizations refer to the WHO, CDC, FDA, and NIH policies to justify their censorship. Other subjects of suppression by TNI now include the Russia-Ukraine conflict, climate change, elections and democracy, and many others.
Today's News Talk Radio.
I do a lot of streaming radio.
I do a lot of free streaming.
TNTradio.live.
We're back with Slobodan Despo. You were explaining, Slobodan, what happens next in terms of French support after Hollande and potentially after Macron. Does the current rebellion on the streets portend a significant creation of new party in the absence of the destruction of the socialists and so forth? Is there a pro peace? Is there a pro-Russian? Is there an anti-American line that's going to be popular in France that would make a political difference?
Well, there is an anti-American. I don't know. It's rather anti-American than pro-Russian line, but there is a very, very strong anti-American feeling among the people. But it is not. It has no counterpart. Real counterpart in the public life in political structures of France. But the parties, you know, in the Netherlands, you have now a strong, I forgot the Peasants Party.
Yes.
In Austria, In Austria, you have people, you have parties, at least one, that is anti-NATO, anti-national, and they show it. In you have parties in Germany that are significant opposition to NATO, but not in France. In France, you have two movements which are courageously standing up against all that. It's Florent Philippot, who is a former member of the far right Rassemblement National, of National Front, who has Florent Philippot has a very small party, and you have Asselineau, who is also a very smart man, he's a Frexiter. But all these people, you know, they can rely on 2 or 3% of the votes. So France is politically completely neutralized, I would say. And
what about on the intelligence side and on the military side? We've seen in Germany 2 or 3 mm-hmm. retired generals. We've talked about them on this program before, who've articulated opposition to US and NATO strategy in the Ukraine for fear that that strategy will be defeated on the battlefield and that will destroy NATO's credibility in Europe forever. That's their line. They're not anti-NATO. They're anti-defeat. They don't want to see defeat. Now, Jacques Beau, who's, as you understand, a veteran NATO staff officer, a Swiss, but working in a Paris think tank, is the only particular French voice I read who's arguing something similar. Or have I misunderstood? Is there a line of thinking among the French military and intelligence services which might say something like the German? If we don't save the war from a Russian victory, we'll all be lost. Is there any line like that in France?
Yes, there is. You can read, for instance, Eric Denessé, who is a former intelligence officer, and he's running a private intelligence company now. It's called CF2R, and he's on the same line. He's very aware of what is going on. You have lots of retired generals, colonels, like our friend de Lavarde, like my friend Jacques Hogard, who write, who gather people. There's a lot of private confidential newsletters that are being exchanged within lower and middle ranking French officers that are on this line, because they perfectly know that what the heads of the army and the president, who is the commander of French army, what they are proposing is a suicidal war against Russia. The chief of staff of French army last year published I got his letter to the officers' corps, which was complete madness. He was telling them get prepared to a war against Russia, and they were asking what war, with what weapons are we going to fight against Russia? We are bound to lose. There's no way. And this is they are all completely aware, except of course those armchair generals that you talk about very often, which are, you know, constantly sitting on the TV shows, but they don't represent the mainstream opinion of the French army. I'm confident they don't.
But not enough strength in this line to make a difference to France's attempts to deliver AMXs, armored vehicles, and Leclercs to Ukraine? Or is that a PR stunt? The vehicles will never arrive. Is France, is Macron making public statements which the military and the intelligence services declined to implement? Are there two lines, the public one in support of NATO, the private one that's different? And does the action in the streets, the breakdown of public order, the disappearance of parliament, does this make any difference to the way military men think about their future in France?
You know, what happens in the streets is a clear sign to everybody. Well, to everybody, because everybody is aware that this can turn into a complete havoc. These demonstrations, these fights could completely block the country. And whether you are a military, you are intelligence, you are administration, you know that you cannot go on very, very much longer with this completely suicidal policy that is crippling your army, your weaponry, crippling your finances, and people not reacting. They are reacting. I mean, they are reacting to this. How come their government is destroying the health system, healthcare system, but it always has enough money to send to Ukraine? That's a very frequent question, and it cannot go much further. And I would add one thing that we have been studying. Nobody observed this in France, because they dare not. In France, you have a very strong, as you know, Arab immigration and African immigration. That is occupying. I mean, they're living around the cities, you know, in the suburbs, and they live in compact suburbs where French police and even firemen don't enter anymore. And these people, a journalist, a friend of mine, French journalist, said to me that in these suburbs he has seen Russian flags. So these people, all connected to their home, to the mother countries in Europe, in Africa, in Algeria, all those Morocco. Countries in Morocco, in black and deep Africa, all those countries have switched sides during the last year. They're all siding with Russia.
And let me ask you about what's happening on. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're running out of time, and I want to extract as much as we can from you, Slobodan. We hope you'll come back again. In the videos clips that you've shown, in the video clips that our listeners will have seen in the United States, Canada, and Europe of street behavior, what one sees is principally white young people being beaten up by police and gendarmes and military units, with a level of cruelty that's very unusual to see. The level of cruelty, the level of hatred that one sees from the official side, municipal police, gendarmerie, and army, and special so-called riot units, that level of cruelty is remarkable to see in Europe, first. And second, I saw this incident in which the police had very seriously beaten up some elderly people. I'm elderly. I don't know what their age was. But the prefect refused to allow the ambulances to pick them up. That's a level of official cruelty and hatred, which is a sign of civil war. When blacks and Arabs from the bidonville, the poor neighborhoods of the city, see that, they know that for the first time they're seeing whites treated the way they've always been treated by those forces. But with that level of hatred in the streets, is that new for whites in France?
Well, yes, it's new. In a way, because when you had those far right demonstrations in the 1930s, they were shot at by the police. French police state is a very serious police state. You know, I remember Edward Limonov, who was living there in France, told me, I was his publisher at some point, he told me, you know, you'd better not deal with French police. You'd better. And he knew about police, you know, the Russian police, Soviet police, and American police. And he said, no, you'd better not. And what they are seeing now is, what? First of all, as you know, I've signaled that. I was caught in a demonstration with Yellow Vest, and I did not believe that those provocations were coming from the police side. And I witnessed that they started beating people and dousing them with gas without any provocation from the demonstrators. Not at all. I was in the first ranks. I saw it. Nothing was happening. They gassed, you know, people with babies, elderly people, passers-by, people coming out from their shopping on Place de la République in Paris, and they closed all the streets, allowing people to escape except one. So it provoked a huge panic, and people were, you know, they were stomping on each other. And this was, I mean, obviously a policy. And by the way, the police prefect, the police boss of Paris, Mr. Lallemand, who is infamous in France, recently he said in an interview that the police might have to shoot, with real bullets on their population, on the middle class. And he even stated the middle class. Middle class is not the Arabs. It's not, you know, marginal people. It's the population of Paris. Then yes, this, you know, it smells like civil war in a way.
That's a very grim prospect. So, in what happens next it's spring, young people like to be in the streets. All of us like to be in the streets when spring is coming.
Yeah.
If the perception is that the prefects threaten to use live ammunition, if the police show a level of hatred for their fellow citizens this way, is the deterrence, the suppression, the repression of executive rule by a president, that's rule without democracy, we'll skip the F word that describes. Mm. Is that what's coming to France? And does it galvanize around in any way the war in the Ukraine? Or is that issue as still marginal in France as it remains marginal, for example, among American voters?
Well, for the moment, the issue is marginal because their attention is drawn elsewhere. But first of all, this power in France, Macron's power in France, just as the governments of other Western countries now, they have no reverse gear. They have no reverse gear, and they have no idea of diplomacy. Just as the United States have and NATO have no diplomacy anymore, just the same way they have no inner diplomacy towards their own people, as you very well know. No, the Dutch police has shot with live ammunition on their own people. The French might do it. Anyway, they don't have a license to kill, but they have a license to maim, because dozens of people lost their eyes and hands in those demonstrations. And it might get worse, but there's no reverse. There's no reverse gears. There's not even brakes. Mr. Macron will not talk with these people. He will talk with children's magazines because it's easier and it comforts him. That's the perspective. But of course, a country that is in such a state of distrust and inner hatred cannot, even if they decide to go, you know, to find a solution with a war, it will not work with these people.
Thank you, Slobodan. I'm sorry we're running out of seconds.
Well,
and not running out of sense. I hope you'll come back. I hope our listeners get a flavor that you're capable of providing.
I'll be happy.
For what comes from France and how it will affect the War of the Worlds. To watch and understand more of what you're saying, the audience should go to antipresse.net, antipresse.net. And we hope we'll see you again very soon. We wish you good luck and avoid provocation.
So do I.
Yeah. Keep your head down, Slobodan. We'll all keep our heads down, but our brains working. Thank you very much for coming on this evening.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much.